Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. Welcome to the Hoban Minute. I'm sitting here today with my friend, president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Mr. Bob Hoban. This is a one-on-one episode with myself, Eric Singular, and of course, Bob Hoban. There's a lot to cover. It's U.S. Cannabis Week here at the Hoban Law Group, and in the spirit of capturing all the things that are going on here in America with cannabis, we do have an upcoming election. And so, of course, that is on everybody's mind. That seems to be kind of the flavor of the news and everything that we're imbued with all the time. So we know that there are a couple of states that have a ballot initiative for legalization, whether it's that's in a medical or recreational capacity here in November. And we just talked to Sarah, and what was interesting is that Oregon is taking a very progressive step with psilocybin, a psychedelic, and then just largely decriminalization of all drugs, all controlled substances, which is an interesting step to take for sure. And Colorado is also kind of one of these places where we see that kind of progressiveness as it relates to drug policy. So obviously there's a lot going on election-wise, but Bob, what's kind of on your radar for, you know, as cannabis is concerned, what we may see in the coming months as a result of this election in November?
It's a great question. It's a question I don't know if I have a lot of answers to, except to say, you know, there's certainly analysis out there that, you know, here's what would predictably happen if the Biden-Harris ticket won regarding federal policy. Here's what could happen if Trump were to become reelected. I certainly think that you'll see continued momentum towards legalization. And, you know, one of the things about the United States is, unlike other countries in the United States, we tend to enact cannabis reform or cannabis legalization or legislation through citizen-initiated measures. The citizens must petition and vote, or the politicians refer it to the citizens to vote. There seems to be not a lot of strong leadership at all across the United States. It's almost like a hot button issue. In fact, our own former governor Hickenlooper was just such a weak leader on this particular issue, and now likes to take credit for it, even though he was sort of a impediment to the enactment of the cannabis legislation here in Colorado. But policymakers are still skittish on the issue, so the citizens must speak up. And I would predict that the ballot measures that do exist this year, that they will pass, if for no other reason, because of the economic upside of it. I think that's on a lot of people's minds. We've seen that trend. You and I have talked about it a lot, where different places around the world are looking at cannabis legalization as an economic driver, or perhaps an economic savior, depending on, you know, where things are. And I think that is in the front of a lot of people's minds, because we are in an economic downturn. Jobs, society's just not the same. So this is a viable alternative from an economic perspective that may or may not continue to create jobs and the like. And I think that's what's on the front of voters' minds.
You know, speculating on a Biden-Harris win a little bit, I'm thinking back to one of your Forbes articles, which was about what would have happened potentially if Hillary Clinton had won. And of course, she had spoken about rescheduling cannabis, high THC cannabis, into like a Schedule 2, which really would open up that pharmaceutical lane, policy lane, and regulatory lane that we've talked about, but not necessarily being an advantage to what we've seen in legalization in the states, which is these individual states taking a stance like Colorado. And there was almost even a threat to Colorado, Washington, these states that have legalized, if there was a federal policy change. What would that mean for a state that has a recreational, commercial, regulated market like we do here in Colorado? So I wonder, we know that Biden hasn't really taken a strong position. There was the task force that recommended a couple of things, but do you know, in that Forbes article, you kind of mentioned what may have happened under Hillary Clinton presidency. What do you foresee in that capacity from a rescheduling perspective or just any kind of federal policy change that would come from a Biden-Harris ticket?
Well, so this is the interesting thing, and it's a thing that a lot of folks don't like to talk about, particularly dyed-in-the-wool Democrats. Kamala Harris and Joe Biden have put more people behind bars, probably collectively, for marijuana offenses than any tandem that I could possibly think of at that high of a political level because of policy, so forth and so on. Now, with that said, we have to acknowledge that politicians evolve, policy positions evolve, and at least Biden and Harris have said the right things for purposes of the cannabis community. They've said that, for example, that it should be decriminalized to the extent that, you know, we shouldn't see impact on minority communities that we've seen since the three strikes and you're out and the mandatory minimum sentences that were part of Biden's federal legislation from decades ago, from Harris's position as a prosecutor putting people for marijuana offenses behind bars. So that's an evolution of their positions, and politicians are supposed to evolve. So from a criminal justice perspective, I think you'll see the lightening of the impact on folks for possession or simple possession and distribution charges. From a general, more broader policy perspective, their ticket has come out, hasn't gone as far as, say, Bernie Sanders or Cory Booker and said, let's legalize it. But what they have said is it is sensible to leave that issue to the states, which frankly is a Republican position, but it suits the Democrats well here, and it reflects the States Act. It reflects what we've seen and frankly reflects what I think is good public policy at the federal level. You don't need to go outright and legalize cannabis and create agencies and oversight by the federal government. Leave it to the states who can regulate and do things at the local level. We've seen many success stories across the states that have legalized and commercialized cannabis in some form or fashion. And if there's a federal baseline that states must adhere to, that's probably where this goes in the event of a Biden-Harris win in November.
Absolutely. And another thing to highlight, because it has happened since the time we recorded our last one-on-one Hoban Minute, was Governor Polis here in Colorado enacting some form of expungement. That's certainly a nice thing because, as we've talked about and as you just said, Hickenlooper was not extremely progressive, was even a little bit of an inhibitor to cannabis legalization. So in the spirit of social justice and in that kind of spirit of allowing people to participate meaningfully in the industry who maybe had a prior offense, what did you think seeing that Governor Polis enacted that?
Governor Polis always, it doesn't surprise me, he just always makes me smile. Everything he does is so pragmatic, so practical, so thoughtful, that when something like this happened, and you know that didn't come out of thin air, but it just demonstrates what a thoughtful politician and someone who really just wants to make progress can accomplish. And I think he's really done great things for Colorado. He did great things, I believe, when he was in Congress. Forget about political lines, R's versus D's. He's just a good politician. He takes an issue, he's decisive, he makes a decision, he does it in a smart fashion. And in this case, he did something that's long overdue. And by the way, let's not forget about this. When legalization occurred in Colorado, John Hickenlooper was not of the mindset to, let people free for marijuana offenses or wipe out those records. That was not something that Hickenlooper would even entertain. You know who did, though? District attorney from Boulder, a guy by the name of Stan Garnett, who was a great leader on that particular issue. And unfortunately, he ran and failed to be the attorney general several years ago. But the point is, this is an issue that politicians have to address, particularly in states that have legal commercialized cannabis, and Polis did the right thing yet again, not just on cannabis issues. He just seems to do the right thing more often than not, regardless of the R's versus the D's issue. And really proud to have him as our governor.
And I think that's kind of the biggest takeaway just from this little conversation is that it's no surprise that we live in an extremely polarized society right now politically, and everything is always amplified to that agenda and to that end to really get people divided, it seems. But what we're talking about in as it relates to cannabis policy is it's public policy. And it doesn't, yes, the Republican and Democratic, the conservative versus liberal philosophy is all in there, but there is just good public policy and really allowing states to make that decision, letting that, you know, operating without interference. And what I see is if there is the need for the federal government to participate in some kind of way, and where I really see that is on the research end, you know, I know that this is kind of near and dear to your heart, that there is this argument out there. You have something that's a Schedule I substance. What does that mean? It means there's no medical benefit. But then you have compelling evidence that there is not only a medical benefit, there's a huge industry making millions and millions and millions, if not billions and billions of dollars behind it. So between the benefits of the plant and the fact that the research that is allowed at the federal level is only, as we've talked about at the University of Mississippi, to reinforce the drug angle, the controlled substance Schedule I angle.
To look for reasons why it's bad.
Exactly. And we know all that's changing. We've talked about that, yes, and covered how the DEA has loosened that. And there may be more federal research allowed in the coming months and years on cannabis. It is, it's not a red or blue issue. It really is, what is sensible? We're allowing states to do this, be experiments for success. And we will, you know, I'd like to see policy at the federal level that's just, if there's an obstacle that we need to address, we'll address it. Otherwise, we'll kind of stay out of it and let, you know, figure it out. You know, and it was interesting talking to Sarah that Canada was really the model that got the European Union excited. I'm interested if what's happening in the United States with individual states legalizing and being the drivers, if that excites the European Union at all. You know, let France and the UK do their thing, be an experiment for success or failure so that you can learn and then create that sensible policy at a higher level. You know, it's just all food for thought, but just kind of throwing it out there.
The issue of Canada, I mean, think about this for a minute. As Americans, it's easy to look to the north and say, oh, they're so progressive because of their health care and because of their cannabis policy. But let's not forget that Trudeau is not sort of the favorite son of the Canadians, and it's a far more conservative country than the media would lead you to believe. So in the face of all of that, they just enacted good public policy. They took steps through a progressive leader, Trudeau in that particular instance, based on campaign promises, but it still was the legislative body behind him that enacted this legislative scheme, and it works. It works for so many different reasons because, Eric, you pointed out, it's just good public policy. It's not right versus left. It's right versus wrong. What's right? What's the right thing to do on a particular issue? What's in the best interest of the citizens? And unfortunately, that is far too often ignored for political reasons, and that's been exacerbated under the current presidential administration. And hopefully we can go back to some sort of level of civil discourse. That's my great hope. In fact, you know, to that end, there's these Supreme Court hearings going on with potential Justice Barrett. And, you know, Senator Graham, the judiciary chair from South Carolina, a Republican, did lament in his opening comments that, you know, what happened to this level of civil discourse? What happened to the respect and the courtesy? And he gave an example of two Supreme Court justices, and we've talked briefly about them, for Justice Scalia, you know, perceived to be sort of a very conservative right-wing jurist, and of course RBG, the recently deceased RBG, Justice Ginsburg, on the left. Both of those Supreme Court justices were approved by something like 96 or 97 out of the 100 senators. Think about that. 96 out of 100. It wasn't 96 Democrats or 96 Republicans. It was a mixed bag of R's and D's that approved someone who was perceived to be so far extreme to the right, Scalia, and so far extreme to the left, Ginsburg, by 96 out of 100, 97 out of 100. What happened to those days? And here we are. Yes, it's an election year, so it's exacerbated. Yes, the discourse has gotten extremely polarized. But What's the right thing to do? To examine this justice's qualifications and to vote, it's going to come down along party lines, and that's going to be a narrow victory. What is that, one way or the other, 51-49 or the like? Are we ever going to see anybody get approved by 96 or 97% just because it's the right thing to do, because that person's qualified, not because they're on my side or your side? So it really comes back to what is the right thing to do. And I do believe, Eric, that there is a right thing to do, that there is good public policy that public politicians can pursue. And, you know, we saw that in Canada. We saw that with Polis recently. And, you know, frankly, I think we're seeing that happen in, you know, you use France as an example. We're seeing good public policy move forward in other countries around the world. Not to pretend that there's not this political divide in other countries like there is in the U.S., because there certainly is, and there always has been, and there always will be. But is it to the exclusion of just what's good public policy? I don't know. And that's what's frustrating. And the cannabis debate seems to be at the center of that, certainly for us, because I think unequivocally the data, the information, the successes of regulated cannabis, the access to this as a therapeutic, if not a medicine, that is good public policy. That is something that people should have access to. And other countries seem to get it right. And here we are stuck at the federal level, at least, in this tremendous divide. And that's why I'm far more hopeful that states can solve problems, because there does seem to be more discourse, more focus on what is good public policy, what's in the interest of our citizens in this particular state, versus politicizing every single issue.
Well, and that was a really great point. So there's a lot of directions to go from that. But what I want to try to highlight is taking into consideration that the actual country that we live in, because I think it's easy to formulate in your mind what the United States is and these huge political divides and the everything that's going on in this country. But if you really take a step back and we just look geographically for a moment at the United States, this is a huge country. If you look at the European Union and the countries in Europe, it fits inside of the United States. If you look at Latin America, there are entire countries in Latin America that fit in the state of Colorado, or, you know, just certain jurisdictions. So this is a huge country, and you have these major population centers. And this is kind of where I want to bring this back to, which is one of the things on the ballot this year, and what's been a huge conversation since the 2016 election, is moving away from the Electoral College, moving towards the popular vote. But this country is huge, and there is the majority of people live in just a few population centers and cities around the country. And then you have this huge areas of land where you have rural communities, rural economies, you have farmers, you have industries, you have what's left of American manufacturing, if you will, out there in rural parts of the country. And so let's get your thoughts a little bit on this issue, because it's a big issue. Should we move away from the Electoral College? Is there some advantage to the Electoral College versus the popular vote? There's a compelling reason for why people have taken an issue with that. But let's consider for a moment what the Electoral College offers that we may not think about, given how large our country is.
Well, first of all, this country was built on a foundation that the people that live in rural America, those red spots that make up 90, 92% of the landmass, when you go red versus blue, they matter. They absolutely matter. And they need to have a voice. They deserve to have a voice. The country was built on that. And frankly, as Coloradans, we're also, I wouldn't say we're certainly not a red state, but we're representative of sort of this land of redness in between two blue coasts, right? So it's not sufficient to say that those folks, their voice shouldn't count as much, or that the trends and the patterns should be dictated by the population areas. So that's why the Electoral College was installed in the first place, right? To protect the rest of the country, including places like Colorado, from those heavy population centers like California and New York and the Northeast. And not there's anything wrong with those people. There's nothing wrong with it at all. It's just there needs to create a balance. So think about this right now. If you have a state like California, which is overwhelmingly Democrat, overwhelmingly blue, by way of popular vote, with 40 some odd million people, if California, because it has so many people that vote a particular way, not judging that one way or the other, should that make a person's vote in Nebraska or Wyoming or Colorado or somewhere in the South or the Midwest matter less just because there's so many more people in that state? The answer historically has been no. That shouldn't have more weight than folks in those rural areas, those red areas that make up the vast majority of this country. That's why the Electoral College exists. So when you think about that issue, should we vote with a straight popular vote? Well, we talked about this before we came on the air tonight, and that was there's been five presidents in history that have won the election yet lost the popular vote. Most recently, of course, President Trump. Prior to that was President Bush. And then way, way, way back, and I'm going to get this wrong, but I think it was John Quincy Adams, Benjamin Harrison, and one other president. I just can't
Rutherford.
Rutherford B. Hayes.
Rutherford B. Hayes.
They won the election. So this is not a new problem, Eric. This is the press would have you believe that, oh, this is a new thing. We need to change things. This same issue has existed previously. And by the way, in as far as I could tell, in those five instances where presidents lost the popular vote but won the election because of the Electoral College, they tended to be conservative or more conservative politicians, which meant that the Electoral College actually seemed to do its job. It seemed to give the balance to that massive redness across the country against and balanced out the blueness. So with five times in our country's history where this has occurred, to me, does not mean that we should have a legislative change to our Constitution at the federal level, nor does it mean that each state should just make a knee-jerk reaction and change the way that it tallies its vote and give everything based on popular vote winners. Now, as the country becomes more politically divided, as we try to jam every single policy issue, this is a problem with American politics. You have to jam every single policy issue you can conceive of into one of two boxes. That doesn't make sense, Eric. Hypothetically, what if I am anti-abortion, but I am, you know, pro-gay rights and I like small government? There's just no party for me. I have to, and by the way, to think that every person that's R or D or red or blue agrees with every tenet of that party is absurd. That's just not true. I mean, certainly there are people that are, but your average American cannot take all of those policy issues and their personal beliefs and jam them into one box or another, but you have to in American politics. So because of that, is there a chance that as we go forward that, you know, things will become balanced and regain some semblance of less divisiveness and less partisanship? It's possible, but it's also not a new issue for this country. You know, the political rhetoric, the divisiveness, the acerbic nature of our politicians going after each other, the R's versus the D's, none of this is new. And you can go back historically, literally 150, 200 years where, you know, the vitriol, the hatred between the politicians, excuse me, and the press that covered them, it wasn't that much different than today. It's just today there's so much scrutiny because the media is so pervasive. And plus, everybody has a platform because of digital technology. So it makes it seem worse than it's ever been. And maybe it is, but I would also suggest that that's not a reason to make a what I would strongly call a knee-jerk reaction. Having two Electoral College winners that lost the popular vote, two of them in the last 20 years, does not mean we need to go and make changes. Now, if this continues to be a pattern and it happens year in and year out, and there's another more sensible way to strike that balance, and I want to stress that the Constitution, the country deserves and requires that balance between heavy population areas and those red areas on a map. It needs to occur. That's the foundation of this country. There needs to be a balance there somehow, some way. Maybe there's a better way, but right now I'm not convinced that that legislative change eliminating the Electoral College is required, because we're talking about five times in history over 200 plus years, and that's a pretty good record.
Well, it's a profound meditation on care, on what people actually care about. Just like you said, nobody, for the most part, really fits into one of those two camps. That binary system has created a real challenge. And the thing I think it's interesting, because we focus so much on cannabis, and just looking at your history and everything you've done in the last decade with cannabis policy, you have to work with both Republicans and Democrats. And you have to work with Republicans who are despised by Democrats, and likely liberals who are despised by conservatives. But somebody has to try to pull it all together to advance a certain thing. In this instance, really, for you, is cannabis policy, which I think is just very interesting in this conversation around we live in a binary system, but cannabis is not a binary issue. It does not fit neatly under one of those camps. You look at the huge economic potential of cannabis, and that really, in my mind, falls under the more conservative thinking. You look at agriculture, you look at McConnell being the champion of the farm bill, and a lot of farmers out there who are conservative and see hemp as a more probably conservative issue. But then you look at the criminal justice side, the social justice, criminal reform, expungement. All of that seems to fall more on the liberal side. But it's interesting, especially to hear from you and hear you talk about it. It's not a political. We're not talking about it in a political way. This is the civic discourse that's kind of missing, because you have been successful in the fact that you're able to navigate both sides of that coin, working with people on both sides of the equation to advance something forward. It's really something we need in a lot more facets of our society beyond cannabis. But cannabis seems to be a good vehicle, and especially in your experience, to really move that forward and get people to work together who wouldn't otherwise. I think about the Rohrabacher FAR, getting people from both sides to come together and recognize this is just the right thing to do. As you're saying, this is just sensible. So it is a profound meditation on very complex issues, in that it's more complex than what you're led to believe by just watching the news or kind of taking the version of everything that wants you to just kind of fall on one side. There's a lot more to it. It's a great conversation to have.
It is, and you know, part of that, I think, Eric, is that people that become indoctrinated to one side or the other, and I say that completely objectively. I mean, you know, I personally, my political philosophy falls more in line with libertarian philosophy. And by the way, I think that I would tell you, I'd say most average Americans align with a libertarian philosophy, which is sort of a live and let live. We don't want the government to be too pervasive, but we want everyone to have equal rights and be allowed to exist and experience freedom in this country. I think most people are aligned with that, and that philosophy kind of traipses across both of the political parties, right? So when people convince themselves that their side is right, and that there's a consensus, I think that's what causes problems in society. Because in the best case scenario, Eric, the best case scenario, everything is about as close to 50-50 as you can possibly imagine. And people pretend that's not the case. They think that they're 50%, or maybe it's a little more, maybe it's a little less. They think that that represents a consensus or a vast majority, and it's simply not true. And, you know, cannabis is a great example of that, because in a certain respect, we look at here's how cannabis should be regulated and here's what needs to happen. Well, you've convinced yourself that that's the right way to do it, when in reality, to your point, to move something forward that hasn't been legalized before, certainly hasn't been commercialized, not to this extent before, you have to work with policymakers that come from both sides of the aisle. So the quote-unquote right answer, the right thing to do, is to look at how to legalize cannabis. But that doesn't mean that a liberal approach to that or a Republican approach to that or a conservative approach to that is the quote-unquote right way to make the right decision on that policy issue, it's always going to be an amalgamation, a sausage factory, right? In the sense that you take a little bit of this and you take a little bit of this and you compromise and you create something that works. Does it work perfectly? Oh, no, nothing ever works perfectly. This is the thing about the government. But it tends to advance that particular policy issue, which is in the public's best interest, and it's not done in an R way or a D way. It's done in a way that creates a piece of sausage that takes a little bit from both sides, and that's what this country's been founded on, whatever the policy issue is, and that's what we seem to forget, that we convince ourselves that our side is the majority or the consensus or the popular view, when in reality, it's never that way. It's just never that way. And not all policy issues, including and especially cannabis, fit into one of those left or right boxes.
So we're left with how to conclude this conversation. And I think my biggest takeaway is that we really do, as a society, with where we are, and there's a lot of people out there who maybe think it's broken. They don't. They feel very disillusioned with the entire thing. But we need more people who can get both sides to work together. That is kind of what I see in cannabis. It's what I see in the work that you do. That just, it moves things forward when you can get people to work together. And like you're saying, it is making sausage. It's not beautiful. There's a lot of compromise in it. But it moves things forward because you're able to bring people together who otherwise, and on other issues, they may be completely opposed. But that's what it takes. Progress requires people who disagree on a lot of things to come together. It's a very difficult thing. It takes a long time. None of it can be solved overnight, but we need more people who are willing to try to bring people together. So, Bob, you do great work. And it is something that we don't highlight maybe enough, just that ability to put the politics aside for a second and just realize that moving things forward and getting sensible policy requires getting people to work together. It's a difficult job. Someone's got to do it.
So someone's got to do it. And Eric, here's the way I would look at it. If there's a particular policy outcome, cannabis legalization, that's the goal. You can see it out there, right? If I convinced myself that there's one road to that destination, and I just said, this is the road we're taking, then I would be wrong from the very get-go. And that's what people do. You have to look at every fork in that road towards that destination, and you have to say, okay, whether I like it or not, I have to compromise with you on a particular issue, and maybe we're not going to take this road, we're going to take this other parallel road, but we're still going to get to the destination. It's just not the exact road to get there that I had conceived in my mind. And that's business, that's politics, that's life, and that's what everybody seems to forget, that there is not one path to a particular destination. And, you know, ultimately, cannabis policy is a great example of that, because you have to reach across the aisle. You have to reach across different strata of government, local, state, federal, international governments at this point in time. And you have to accept that, yes, it might be the smoothest way in your mind to get from point A to point B to do it this way, but it's never going to happen that way. And if you are wed to that singular path, then you're going to get disappointed. You're going to get frustrated, and you're probably going to fail, because nothing in life ever works out that way.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law, and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.